friends. This is Against Everyone with Connor Abib. That was obviously some wolf howling or wolf song at the top of the show, because this episode is about wolves. This episode of the show, like all episodes of the show, is made possible only through support from Patreon patrons who support the show at patreon.com/ConnorHabib. There are no ads, there's no sponsors, there's just this connection between the show and its listeners. So if you do like the show, I ask that you support it at patreon.com/ConnorHabib. Thank you so much if you already do support it. This episode is also part of a series of episodes on science and how science and scientific concepts interact and intersect with our lives. Across these episodes, we'll be considering the healing and connective powers of the void of space, terrifying encounters with predators, the development of the concept of nature, reflections on our own animalistic violence, the truth and complications of the scientific method itself, and the ways in which we connect at the tiniest layers of existence. These episodes are not scientific episodes per se, but they also aren't scientistic either. Each one is an exploration of what science can bring into our lives. On this episode, we'll be staying close to the wolf. The wolf is both living myth and skulking shadow in our imaginations. It's also a flesh and blood animal that uniquely relates to both space in their range and encroachment and disappearance from certain territories, and also time in reintroduction strategies, bringing the wolf back into places where it used to live, and old fears that we hold onto but don't make sense today. We can learn a lot from wolves if we allow ourselves to sit with what they rouse in us. One of our greatest wolf contemplators is my guest on this episode. It's cultural theorist and nature writer and philosopher Erica Berry, who wrote the excellent Meditation on Wolves and Human Beings, Wolfish, Wolf Self, and the Stories We Tell About Fear. I'm so happy with this episode because it really illustrates what I'm trying to do with this science series, which is to talk about something that is usually in the realm of science, in this case, wolf behavior, wolf biology, that sort of stuff, and see how it just kind of spins out into all these different things for us to think about. In this case, desires, violence, communication with people and animals, why we shirk away from hurting some animals but then just eat others and put them in factory farms, the experience of non-humans, what that's like for them to just be in the world and be prey, writing nonfiction, and more. I'm so happy to offer this episode to you, and I hope you love it. Here we go. Hi, everybody. This is Against Everyone with Connor Abib. Hello, Erica Berry.
Hi. So nice to be here.
Hi. Okay, where to even begin? I think we'll talk about a lot of things that like are kind of wolf adjacent, but maybe not directly wolfish. But I do want to start right with a wolf, because I was thinking a lot about the way time comes up when you're writing about wolves. So the Green Party leader in Ireland had mentioned bringing wolves back to Ireland, and everybody just kind of laughed at him, and almost rightfully so, because actually trying to do that on this little island, it seemed like just kind of a bit of a joke to almost say something that was like environmentally radical or whatever. But the thing that was interesting was, so there's all these tensions that have to do with the past and the future and also the present with the wolf. And so I just want to talk about time here a little bit.
I love that framing. I feel like I haven't heard that idea of thinking about the wolf as a, it's sort of this tug that carries us into our mythologies and our stories, but also really like on a base ecological level. Like the last time that wolves were roaming all over the United States, for example, it looked really different, right? The wolf becomes like a bellwether of the change that has happened. And I think the thing that comes immediately to mind is how much of our kind of contemporary landscapes, both in the UK and in America, have been shaped by wolves not being there. You have examples of forests being burned to rid the area of wolves. You have, like, in Ireland, I think this was also a case where forests are shaped, like the landscape is distinctly shaped by the absence of wolves. And so then you think about putting wolves back into these landscapes that are shaped by their absence, right? There's this really interesting tension where I think there's so much fantasy about what if we could go back to before this sort of sin of industrialization. I mean, I say that and I feel that, right? Like I have grown up in under the understanding that our environment is degraded and will just continually be degraded. And it's, I think, the experience of getting older in that sort of place is a hard thing to hold. I'm driven a lot by those sort of feelings of anxiety is like too flat of a word, I think. It's looking for awe in the natural world and also feeling a deep grief and a deep culpability in that feeling personally as a human. And so I think one of the things that the wolf does is you think, well, if this wolf is comes back, you know, the studies from Yellowstone show that wolves are reshaping the whole kind of ecosystems. Now, those studies, for example, that if a wolf is wandering around, deer and elk are going to be more afraid, so they're not going to graze on shrubs, and so there's going to be more birds, like these sort of trophic cascades. There's been a lot of like back and forth on those, and people have different feelings about them, but I do think what the easiest version of that narrative is that the wolf will restore the ecosystems to something better, right? It's going to be a sort of counterweight to human presence. And I think that's a fantasy worth questioning. The idea that the wolf as reparative force is there is a really nice idea that I'm skeptical of, as much as I'm skeptical of the idea that the wolf is, you know, well, completely, the wolf is not the enemy. But I also think this idea that the wolf can just like save us from ourselves is also kind of a tempting myth that, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, what does it mean to live in the time we're in now and to grapple with the fact that wolves living beside us are going to live beside highways, they're going to live beside increased wildfires, industrialization, or urbanization? Like, that is the reality of coexisting with wolves right now.
Yeah. I mean, I love that picture of them living, you know, like by the airport and living, you know, and coming into small towns and that kind of stuff. I mean, that's, you know, I lived in LA for a good long time, and that's what you would see coyotes doing. Obviously, these are two different organisms, but it was, you know, you'd walk down the street and you'd see the coyote sitting on someone's front lawn. And here it's foxes, you know, and you see how they take. So that fantasy or the image of them somehow, even using the term rewilding, like using the wolf, is actually not exactly appropriate. It's sort of, it's more like, and I realize this sounds so pejorative, but it's more like creating an invasive species from one that didn't used to be invasive anymore, that actually, again, I'm going to introduce something from the past. And this is also like, maybe we can talk a bit later about how wolves tie into fascist imagery a lot, but that is like one of the big components of fascism is the idea that you will reach into the idyllic past and somehow bring it into the present and kick out all the elements that are like somehow undesirable to you about the present. And that will happen by revitalizing the past or where you came from. And I'm not saying, although conservatism and conservation do share a root, I'm not saying that conservation or introducing species that were not there that aren't there anymore back to the environment is necessarily fascism. But you can see how these like kinds of threads begin to tie together when you begin having these kinds of fantasies. Yeah.
Completely. And I think this idea of there being a wild and a domestic, or a sort of a pure and then the human, like, I am so skeptical of those binaries. And I'm thinking of Emma Morris's book, Wild Souls, which I just think is a brilliant book. She's an Oregon journalist who wrote this really philosophical look at what it means to have wild animals. And for example, if you have a wolf that is collared by a GPS or radio collar and you know, its locations are trackable, and perhaps it's been, you know, biologists are capturing it or removing it. What degree, like, this is not a wild creature, in quotes, right, from what our ancestors would have thought of as a wild animal. So what is this, what is the sort of place of that wolf in our psyche? And I think these questions of control and to what degree our relationship with wild animals is about, on the one hand, there's a fantasy of they are living outside of our limits. They are living without our laws. We sort of romanticize wild animals, I think, for being freer, right, of these human things. And yet at the same time, to say that they are not controlled by us is totally false, right? Like, human life is influencing every part of what it means to be a wolf right now, whether that's just like the air pollution or, you know, the landscapes that they're in. They are distinctly, their experience of being a wolf is shaped by being a human. And so I just think we're in this, the Anthropocene, call it what you will, we're in this like real blurry space where the lines between us and them, quote unquote, which for so long humans have defined wolves, we have defined ourselves off of the wolves. And I say we in this, and I mean the sort of like Western fairy tale, hetero sort of, you know, most predominant narratives that I'm interrogating in the book are not universal, but those narratives are like, we are here and we are civilization, and then the wolf is this other thing, right? And we're just in a murky, we're in a murky place right now environmentally where the wolf can't quite, it can't be that pure quote unquote wild that it once was.
Yeah. I mean, I'd almost call them like landscaped animals, like in the way that you're talking about it. Like, we're like somehow engaging with the landscape by attaching ourselves to the wolves through their collars, their tagging, their tracking, all that kind of stuff. It's a kind of, it's almost like a kind of gardening in a really bizarre way. And I think that like, that just includes the fauna. I did an episode a long time ago, like when I first started the show, like a solo episode called Destroy Nature Before It Destroys Us, which is about like, you know, the concept of nature at a distance and the way, the many different ways environmental narratives create a distance between ourselves and nature, which allows a certain kind of perspective. And I want to just say that I don't, like, I also am not, and maybe we can talk about this, but I'm also not on board with the like, well, we are part of nature idea. For me, that also creates problems, but rather that nature is part of us, which is a completely, it's just a different vantage point, which I think offers something a bit more. But it's, I love that you're just saying, like, it's murky, it's not easy, because the ways in which the tensions are expressed when we're talking about ecology and landscapes and animals and managing, like, the strategies, the tactics, and the realities are so murky and strange and in some ways new, but the rhetoric around it is very neat and very, like, defined. And I find that, like, it's not helpful. It's ultimately not helpful.
Yeah. I mean, as you're talking, I'm thinking about this Facebook group I'd stumbled into of people who are tracking sort of wolves and really caring about wolf repopulation in the West, which I count myself in that group. I was really invested in following, but there was a lot of rhetoric that I remember seeing in comments about people being really upset about the collars because they can be somewhat heavy and sort of saying like, this is, it's unfair that we're collaring these wolves and they shouldn't be collared. And of course, like, why are they collared? In part because if they're wandering towards a ranch, the ranchers are going to get a heads up. Like, we've got this wolf nearby and maybe they're going to be changing their herds or bringing in more extra humans to kind of help keep their herd animals safe. So hypothetically, like, the reason you're collaring wolves, one reason is to help prevent conflict with other animals. And so to imagine that if you didn't have that collar on there, the wolf would be freer and easier, like, potentially then you're going to have a shoot, shovel, shut up situation where the wolf is killed in another way. Like, I guess I bring this up just because I think this question of like, how do we cause the least harm to the wolf is one question that you could go in, right? And biologists or people who are advocating for wolf repopulation do not even agree on whether wolves should be lethally managed by biologists. Say, like, if a wolf kills in a herd of sheep, say, does that wolf, is it helpful for that wolf to be killed for the overall, you know, vitality of the species? And like, these are really controversial, sticky philosophical questions, actually. Like, there's not a clear scientific, I mean, even saying this, I have to be really careful because this is such a hot issue, but, you know, this is about things that are beyond science and policy. And I think that's what's always been so interesting to me about this creature, is it's like tapping into just so many things that are not easily kind of assembled on a data chart.
Well, let me go back to the time thing for a second here, because I was thinking about, so in esotericism and occultism, there's this concept of the, you know, about the Fenris wolf from Norse mythology. And it's such a strange concept, but when I remembered it and I was reading your book, I was like, oh man, these things go together so intensely, which is that the Fenris wolf, which for people that aren't listening, is this giant wolf that eventually kills a lot of the gods and is finally at, you know, the end times of the gods, Ragnarok, killed by this god Vidar. But the Fenris wolf, the presence of his body exists in language, and it exists in let me try to get this out in a very plain way. I'm laughing because it's so tied into your book that it's going to sound like I'm just making this shit up, but it's actually like, I can point to, maybe I'll point to the lectures in the show notes or whatever, where these are, but that the presence of the Fenris as wolf, like sacrifice essentially, and presence exists in language, and it exists in language in places where languages die or hold back the truth. So I found this like really profoundly tied into the way in which your book is such an examination of how we obscure seeing one reality in favor of another, and what, not just to get rid of that obscuring, but actually to look into it, to identify with it, to move deeper into it and try to understand it, and then also to unveil at the same time. But that's this whole occult idea that even when people are speaking, so like if you have kind of errant words, you just say things that just slip out of your mouth. Like if you go into a coffee shop and you're like, caffeine, you know, these things that are like, that's when I pick on a lot, because I hear people say stuff like that all the time. I'm like, where are those words coming from? Actually, these kind of throwaway words are remnants of the Fenris wolf's body. Now, this is like such a strange concept that God bless any science fans of Erica's that are listening to this episode, but we'll just deal with it for right now. And that's another sort of time thing. There's this weird thing of holding back time bringing things from the past into the present that are, they're no longer appropriate, but in their inappropriateness create something new when we look at them. And the wolf really seems so central to that picture.
I love that as an idea, and I'm going to be invoking the wolf now in all the little murmurations. I think it is. I think, you know, I'm thinking of something completely separate, which, stick with me for a minute, but Elif Batuman, the writer, talks about the experience of falling in love at one point, and she talks about realizing she's queer in her late 30s, I think, and she says, like, the ways that I'd taught to have sex, to fall in love, were based on these scripts told to me by like pedophilic white man directors. And it's a sort of like quip about the scripts that we inherit. But it made a huge impression on me, because part of what she's saying is the way she'd gone about being in love or seducing or being seduced were sold to her by a certain kind of Hollywood films. Mm-hmm. And when she gave that up, she had to rewrite her experiences of being intimate in the world. And I think that, to come back to the wolf, like, I was thinking about the ways that I learned fear, or the ways that any of us think about moving through the world when we potentially see a threat or are potentially like in competition with something. These are actually like these reflexes that are calling back to many wolf narratives on some level. The ways that I am, when I'm in the forest and I hear a noise, there's this like very rusty apparatus that kind of creaks to life inside me. And that is these old narratives about what happens. And I became really interested in this sort of quote in the book that has its roots in Latin, entre chien et loup in French, between a dog and a wolf. And it kind of refers to this twilight hour when you're walking down the road and you see something and you're not sure if it's a dog or a wolf. And that feeling is both excitement and anticipation and fear, right? There's this like uncertainty about what is there that speaks to both the time that you're in, right? But also to the sort of story you've been told about what is going to happen to your body in that place, depending on who you're running into. And I think like, I don't know. I'm really interested. I'm not a scientist in this degree of like, I can't speak to this. So I'm speaking to this on like a vibes level, not on a like science level. But the degree to which me acting in the world is based on my like physiological impulses of like jumping, scary thing, here I'm afraid of this, versus these are these cultural scripts that I have enshrined inside myself. And I am now playing out when I'm walking in the woods, or when I'm falling in love, or when I'm having an altercation with somebody on the street who's a stranger who's maybe making me afraid. Like, I became really interested in, I guess, for lack of a better word, like, what is my free will around this? How much am I just like performing a cultural script? And I guess I just, this is to me about time as well. Like, how I am so rarely thinking of myself as a product of completely the environment that I'm in. And I'm sort of have this fantasy that I'm completely making my own choices at all moments. And I think writing about narratives of fear, writing about the stories we've told about the wolf and how those stories have like completely become the lens through which I might see the physical animal, I had to really confront the ways that we are all living according to cultural scripts so often. And we are not necessarily interrogating those scripts or questioning them or like inventorying them. I think in some ways this book was like a process of self-inventory where I was like, when I see the wolf, what do I see? And why? And how is that serving reality that I'm in right now?
Yeah. Wow. I mean, just even go back to the beginning of that and thinking about Elif's thing about unmaking a certain way of seeing and then having to remake it. Well, like that rebuilding comes from actually the shock of awareness from looking into what's been inherited. This is something in a different way. I just had this psychoanalyst, Avi Sekhatopoulou, who wrote a book called Sexuality Beyond Consent. She was on and we talked about the ways in which the erotic and the violent intertwine. And I kept thinking about that actually in reference to Wolfish, like because of that, that elation and that arousal in the state of fear. And one of the things that we talked about, and this is a very difficult thing to discuss, but you know, how do we talk about the ways in which arousal and desire are and are not intertwined, and when they aren't intertwined, how they are intertwined, and when they are intertwined, how they're not. In other words, so the way we went into talking about that was like when sometimes if someone is sexually assaulted, their body will nevertheless evince an arousal response, even as the inner experience of desire is saying no. And this can cause all kinds of like confusion and intensity for the person who's engaged, you know, been assaulted. And then also, I mean, there's a whole other frame also then to think about when you think about the person who's sexually assaulting the person. And these kinds of connections between the violent and the arousing or the erotic or the desirous, they're really indissoluble, and and they should be looked into more so we can understand them a bit more. But there's been like a real difficulty approaching that, first out of utter silence and then out of the sort of uncorking that made anything look like, well, if we look into this, it's like we're saying, you know, don't care about sexual violence or whatever, which is not true. And so I thought about that a lot. It just in terms of like your whole book is I'm drawn to the fear. I know the fear mostly isn't real. And yet the intensity of the danger and the risk there is something that's alluring to me. But if I get too close, I've got to back off. It's actually, there's this real like dance and movement with the proximity of danger there that offers so much when you're really willing to look into it. And of course, we want to be able to look into it at all times on our own terms. But then the world erupts around us in certain ways. This guy on the train that was giving you these creepy stories, the guys that were surrounding you on campus, like all these moments where you actually don't get to choose the event that bursts through. And also interesting to think about what makes some of those events threatening, even when they're probably not. Why did I feel the threat? So there's that inner dance. And so that is really like also the figure of the wolf. I mean, it's really profound, this long meditation on that, you know, that tension back and forth in your book.
That's so provocatively and interestingly said. And I'm thinking about Catherine Angel's book, Tomorrow Sex Will Be Good Again, and this idea that like so much of the language around consent and desire and the ways that young women have been taught to sort of legislate that does not leave room for surprise. And the feeling of discomfort and like I'm in this, I mean, I think she's sort of specifically talking in this like young heteronormative context, but I think this applies outward, right? Which is like exploring whether that's, to be frank, like sexually or, you know, in the landscape or just like being a human in the world, there's an element of excitement and intrigue that and uncertainty, right? And I think this comes from like the feeling of anticipation and the feeling of fear feels very similar in the gut. You feel kind of like tingly and nauseous. And I think, how do we make space for having experiences that could be frightening and could be exciting, right? And this to me is taking a train by myself across the country. There's a deep possibility of high highs and low lows there. And I'm choosing that. And I think that's true also for sexual experiences or romantic ones, which is like, you don't necessarily want something that you can fully see all of, right? If it's completely pixelated, and in focus while you're walking into the encounter, that may not provide that same, what is going to happen? How am I going to feel? Like there's that gap between the intrigue. And I think we do suffer from a lack of language around how do you sort of armor yourself to go into these uncertain situations where there can be great growth and also great, I don't want to say harm, but discomfort, potentially there is harm, right? And yet, isn't there still a reason to go through into some of this? I mean, I'm wary of conflating things right now, but I think this is the experience for me of being a young woman was being deeply curious about the world and deeply hungry for it, right? And not wanting to constrain my experiences before I knew what I was constraining. And I didn't feel like there were fairy tales, for example, that taught me how to go forth, much less like contemporary cultural narratives.
Yeah, just in the beginning of that book that I mentioned by Ivy, she starts with one of her analysts saying that she, her analyst said that she had given consent to her partner to slap her. And when she slapped her, she said it was really upsetting, not because it was violating, but because it was, she said, exquisite. And that became very threatening to her as well, that actually the surprise of liking something can be as destabilizing in some ways, maybe not destabilizing in such in the way that it generates a kind of the same kinds of trauma or recursive response or whatever in the body, but that it had become so troubling. And I just think, you know, I'm also thinking about, I recorded an episode with Wes Larson, who co-hosts this podcast called Tooth and Claw, which you might know, the animal attacking human podcast, which is one of the only podcasts I listen to. It was very funny. I had my own like nervous, crazy moment because I have like rock stars and spiritual leaders and like MacArthur Genius Award winning writers on the show. And I'm like, hey, let's talk about philosophy. But when Wes was on, I was so nervous because I was like, oh my gosh, I love your podcast. You know, I don't know why. And I, you know, whatever, hopefully it's not too terrible on that episode, but you know, he was talking about the way in which, and you mentioned this too, and you also mentioned it in the, is it Catherine who went out into Alaska and was
Candace.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry that I got her name wrong the circumstances, but he was just like, you know, I love the feeling of being out in the woods, cause he's a bear biologist, and just, you know, the intensity of like everything being on high alert. And then I was like, yeah, but what about the people that get killed, you know, that live around animals that regularly prey on people? And then we had to sort of parse out what the difference was. But it's hard to actually say what that difference is, other than it's not fun when it can really happen. And I was thinking about this too, in the ways in which we talk about animals and danger, because wild wolf attacks are, especially in the US, like super rare. There's that, I forget, this like region in India where it's like 200 children were killed over like 15 years by wolves. And you know, I find we often, for good reason, especially in the US, but I end up like tripping over our words to like make sure people know that wolves aren't like terrible, or any animal, mountain lions, grizzly bears, crocodiles, whatever it is. And then it's like, yeah, but there are also, you know, so it, again, I'm just trying to sort of tease out like some discussion of like safety and arousal and danger and the ways we talk about things because of our even being on edge as we speak, you know, as you just did too. You're like, well, I'm really wary of, you know, like it's very difficult.
It's very difficult. And I think, you know, it's that sort of like soundbite anxiety that you're going to be taken out of context, when actually what we want to be is like taken into nuance. Like, right. How can anything be read in the most generous, like, I'm trying on these ideas and words way. And like, I really believe we need to create these spaces. And, you know, one of the things I was thinking about the book doing is like, yeah, I'm giving these facts to the reader. I want to like give them certain details, but I also want to like model a form of associative, like sprawling thinking that is like a little unhinged. Because I want us to be able to like do that with our brains and do this free associating, where talking about fear becomes talking about sex, becomes talking about safety. And like, what does it mean if we're talking about those things together? It's so rare culturally that we allow those scripts to kind of create feedback loops. I'm thinking about Natasha Martin's book, In the Eye of the Wild, where she describes being attacked by a bear while she's sort of up in on the Kamchatka Peninsula on the borders of Siberia. And this animal disfigures her. She loses a piece of her jaw and she becomes hospitalized. But it's the sort of like indigenous word for this attack that she refers to is the kiss of death that she's heard there. And that idea of it being an erotic moment where the wild animal and the person are meeting, right, is so interesting. And the really violence that she describes in this book, which is about this attack, is about being in the French hospitals and the sort of like dehumanized way that she's treated through the medical system and all of these. She really wants to be back with her sort of like host family and in this world that's much closer to this. Yeah, her relationship with the bear is not one of foe, a victim and predator. You know, it's this much more complex script. And I think I think that book was fascinating, and this is so interesting. I forgot yeah, there was something else I was going to say related to what you're saying, but I completely agree. Like, think about like Little Red Riding Hood, which was the first sort of like prototypical story that made me think like maybe my own experience belongs in this book, because Little Red Riding Hood is a story that to me had deeply shaped how I thought about the wolf and how many people sort of invoked the wolf in popular culture. And yet that story also has a lot to say about how like the young woman is invoked in popular culture, the girl. And like, what is the figure of the wolf if we're not thinking about who the wolf, quote, is supposed to be chasing, end quote, you know? And so that idea that like one archetype is defined off of the other and you can't look at one fully without looking at the other, like that is a narrative that is so deeply kind of full of intrigue. Angela Carter's story about it is, you know, this woman sort of choosing this dangerous sexuality at the end. And I'm not sure. I mean, my book certainly doesn't go into sort of turning the volume up on exploring those areas as it could have. I was on talking to Catherine May on her podcast, and like we just started talking about pornography and desire. And like there is a way that these conversations, if you like take them further down that road, there are huge implications for like how we are not only as beings that are sort of thinking about our safety, but thinking about our sexuality, thinking about our pure like intimacy, whether you know, you're meeting a body that you do not fully understand. Like, what are those intersections? Those are like moments of intimacy, moments of violence, moments of extreme connection. And I think that whole spectrum is about like, it raises these questions of like, what are the limits of what I know about my body, what I understand about my body? You mentioned the slap, like we are surprised by our own bodies. Mm-hmm. And also fundamentally, we cannot understand the bodies or desires of creatures around us. And I just think about that. I've been asked like, what was it like writing about wolves that you couldn't interview in this book? Wolves are characters that I could not talk to. And I think one of the things I got from that was like, even when I'm interviewing a person, how deeply can I understand them? Mm-hmm. How deeply can I get to like their truth or their sort of like way of being in the world? Like in some ways, the experience of trying to relate the experience of a non-human makes me really think deeply about that dance between how do I relate a human experience on the page that's not my own or that is my own. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I read, you said in an interview, my goal wasn't just to teach about wolves, but to model a certain kind of generative, associative mode of being in the world. And I think that that's like when you're talking about that, the way that one thing leads to another in the, the cliche that like, I mean, I find that really valuable. There's a lot of reasons why that's valuable. One is it usually will take us away from debate with the other and into a way of kind of using what the other person says or what we've heard as a springboard into considering our own conflicting notions and ideas. And I think that that's really, there's a way in which, at least now in our time when, you know, there's so much amplification of divisiveness and debate and people sort of dominating each other in conversations, I do think that that way of thinking can have almost a healing quality where you're just sort of following the path through the woods, and that it lets us touch something that's a bit more artistic, but also it blends an unconscious way of thinking with the conscious mind of examination and contemplation so that you're not just being led around by, you know, the sort of unconscious urge, and you're not just being hyper analytical, but actually you're following something and then thinking about it and following and thinking about it, or maybe thinking about it and then following it, whatever. And so I think that that's really powerful. It's something that in your book really comes across, and I wish people do just more in their everyday lives. It's certainly, as you can tell already, just from talking with me for whatever, like 20 minutes or something, it's the way I talk, you know, with people on the show, and it seems to be what people like about the show, that it just goes wherever it wants to.
But, well, and I think, yeah, just briefly, I mean, I'm just thinking about what you said about there is this metaphor of that compared to wandering the forest. And like, how rarely do we go out into, say, a meadow, a forest, a natural place, and think like every turn that I make is going to be dictated by my own curiosity and sense of what is beautiful. Like if you're actually doing that thing that Little Red Riding Hood does when she gets distracted and lost in the woods, she's just like following the beautiful flower, and then she sees a bird, and then she goes over, and this is like rendered amazingly in these sort of historic picture books sometimes. Her sense of curiosity and distraction lead her into this place of danger, but actually also beauty. And I want to think, I'm thinking about like Jenny Odell's work or this sort of ideas of like, how can we, when I go out on a hike, I'm very often, I am following a path. I've got a certain number of hours. I like know where I'm going. And I think as an exercise for all of us, whether conversationally or whether we're like in rabbit holes on the internet or reading, but also just like moving through the world, like choosing at every point, saying like, tapping into your like intuition and sense of what is beautiful, what is curious, what do you want to follow? Like, that's actually a really hard muscle to cultivate right now. I have a hard time following that.
Yeah. And I also think that like, there's kind of this, let's see if I can say this without creating too much confrontation here, but I feel like this is also the way in which wolves are evil in like, in a sense. So like, let me just say it like in this way. I don't mean wolves themselves. What I mean is like the way that I can really, if I'm looking into that fear or that frustration, that like sort of frustrated anger with wolves or whatever, I can sort of think, well, how do I actually connect to that? Like, what does that mean? And how does that actually connect me to wolves? And was just trying to think about it. And I was thinking, you know, if I try to connect with the inner experience of like prowling in a pack, so it's not just a lone wolf that's killing a sheep or a goat, but actually I'm gathering with a bunch of people or others to run to kill. You know, there are other pack animals. There's wild dogs and lions and orcas. I guess chimpanzees will sometimes hunt in groups or whatever. But there's that roaming across the distances against the elements of the wolf to ameliorate a craving and a desire. And when I connect with that, I'm like, well, fuck, when I do that, usually there's a lot of trouble. It's not that the desire is bad. It's not that craving is bad. It's not that wandering is bad. All those things are fine. But when actually something's leading me so intensely beyond, and I'm trying to bring others in to the pursuit, something is afoot that's not so great. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of where I was just sort of thinking like, well, there's the wandering through the woods and then there's the running in the pack, which mm-hmm. is a bit different. Now, mm-hmm. there are very calm and gentle ways we can talk about being part of a pack. And I've heard you do this and it's in your book too. It's like, well, you're feeding your family mm-hmm. and you're communicating. But there's this other aspect of it that if I think of it in human inner terms, there's trouble there.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think you're speaking to this sort of like the hive mind where one feels like you're not. I mean, if wandering alone in the woods is like me tapping into my, it's like the intuitive eating of kind of exploring, right? Like, what do I really want right now? Like what you're talking about is the opposite of that, right? Which is like, I am a marionette and it is joyful to be tugged by this outer hive mind that is making it so clear, like that sort of frenzy of being part of a group, right? Being part of a larger brain, a larger heart than yourself is very addictive. And I think both experiences are actually about losing yourself, right? They're about, at its best, the fantasy is like this sort of like obliterating boundaries where you become one with something bigger. Mm-hmm. Those experiences that you're talking about bring to me, for me, it's like the click brain of being a young person mm-hmm. and the sort of, I am part of this organism that is so frothing, to be inside. Like it feels so exciting mm-hmm. that I cannot even conceptualize what it would mean to be on the outside of that. And I'm thinking about literally being, I thought a lot about being like a teenage girl when I was like mm-hmm. thinking about this book and about nemeses and what does it mean to like hate something that you also desire. And mm-hmm. I think, you know, that was sort of what some of these like teen girl nemesis situations were that I was thinking about. And I remember once my father like watching my sort of high school clique and he was like, you guys don't understand from the outside, like you're intolerable. You're all holding hands in the corner of the room. Like this is so annoying. And I just was like so shocked by his experience of our group because to me, I saw this as like, we're so close. We're like this super ego of like closeness and safety and protection because it's so hard to be a 16-year-old girl and look at the like fences we've created around ourselves. And yet, of course, to other people, we were just like an annoying clique in the corner. And I think that gap between like how it felt to be in that and how it looked, it stayed with me. No, Dad, if you're listening to this, I
Hi, Erica's dad. So I think like the thing I'm thinking about too is the ways in which you know, community has become really this deeply poisonous thing in our time. Again, it's not that it can't be sort of liberated or nothing good can be done with community anymore, but the ways in which people gather together and actually feel real love for each other, but only it's only sustained by its insularity. It's only sustained by like no one gets in, and actually it's us against the world. And there are other versions of that. There are versions of it that, you know, family abolitionists talk about, like, well, when you're just kind of looking out for you and your family, you'll do anything to anybody else. And that's a real problem, not just family abolitionists, but also people who are criticizing Nazi Germany and all sorts of things. But like, but the ways in which that kind of it can be, again, real love and affection for the people in group. But as long as it's not open, as long as it's not allowed to circulate, it can become really like jagged or, you know, pointed whenever anything else approaches. And it can also hunt people down. Like, there's that episode, The Pack, of Buffy, the Vampire Slayer, where they all get possessed by a hyena demon. Let's just go there. And like, you know, they're constantly sort of like laughing and bonding with each other. And then they like eat somebody, you know, and it's like, you can just see the ways in which bonding with others and kind of losing yourself in that, it can at once generate something very affectionate, but also extremely violent in its way that it bounds up or binds up that affection.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the idea that that affection is sort of catalyzed by the creation of a border and who is on the outside of that affection, right? And those are really uncomfortable things to think about. Like, I think it's uncomfortable for people to think about feeling perhaps moments where they feel like predator, or where they have something predatory inside them. I don't know. I'm wondering, like, what is the way to not, there's also this human impulse or this sort of contemporary impulse of like, I have this bad tendency and I'm going to like self-flagellate it out and go into this like guilt, right? Like, we are bad. It's sort of tied to misanthropy. It's tied to privilege. It's this sort of like, we have to purge this bad tendency. And I'm thinking about like, where are the limits between where the grouping is generative and positive and about solidarity? And then when does it tip into that kind of toxic, exclusionary narratives? Because sometimes I think those lines are, well, to go back to our earlier word, like they are murky, right? Yeah. There's a way that being a part of a group can be like really nourishing. And then suddenly it turns, there's like a curdling that happens. And I think we really have to, I've written about this, I'm writing about it now, but like, we have to be really honest about the ways that like, it can be really fun to hate something. And I was writing about this in regard to nemeses and like the idea of an enemy and like, what does it mean to have an enemy? It means I'm thinking really focused about this other thing that makes me feel targeted potentially. And like, that is sort of alluring to feel picked, in the sort of most like archetypal, like I'm playing laser tag way and it's exciting to be hunted and it's exciting to hunt. And I think, that's true when you're on team. It's team sports are so fun because you are relying on humans more when you know you're being hunted by another group of humans. Like, there's just something so innate there. And I think we have to kind of be honest about there being a level of fun in this and not just like, I don't know. For so much of how we've related to the wolf is this sort of like giddy feeling of being persecuted by the wolf. And yet like, the wolf is not out there hunting us. The wolf does not care about us, by and large. And yet there's a lot at stake. Human narratives have really put a lot at stake in the idea that we are sort of two enemies that are out to get each other. And we're these two matched killers. And yet like, humans are the hunter of the wolf and the wolf is like not hunting us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's really just something to think about. Like, if the wolf goes extinct, now, I don't know how imminent that would be, but like, the wolf goes extinct, like, what will fulfill like the role of the wolf for us, you know, like what actually are we gaining? So if I just kind of like take the wolf out of the equation completely, will we mourn that we don't have this animal to hate and loathe and fear anymore? Will it probably just become, you know, a boogeyman or, you know, some other, like a saber-toothed tiger or something like that, mm-hmm. where we have this imagining of this thing that used to threaten us, mm-hmm. even as it didn't threaten us mostly. I don't know. It's like I try to think about what will happen when the outer experience, the sort of out-picturing of that need is gone, mm-hmm. if that disappears.
Well, and that's a scapegoat, right? Like the idea of the wolf as a sort of scapegoat for the danger. I'm thinking of like Barry Lopez talks about theriophobia, like the fear of the beast inside us. Like when we externalize that fear and make it the subject of this wolf that we can hunt and trap and look at, now we're safe because we've like hunted this thing. Like you take out that thing and you're just left with like, the thing is inside yourself, and how do you exercise that? I'm thinking about Bruce Chatwin has this book in Patagonia where he sort of fantasizes this history of, I think he calls it the Deinophilus, and it's some creature that the skull is found that could perfectly fit around the human head. And what if we found this fossil of a predator that was meant to hunt humans? And he says, like, wouldn't that be so wonderful to have known that we were hunted specifically? Like we would feel so chosen. And as a result, like, has all of human history, he writes, been a search for false monsters? Like, have we been searching for this Deinophilus our whole life? And if we found this creature that was actually hunting us, there would be this like exoneration of these other creatures that we make into our predators, right? The sharks, the wolves, the sort of the other creatures that are not really hunting us.
Mm. Yeah, I love that. and I haven't read that. I mean, the Songlines is probably his most famous, but like,
oh gosh, maybe this was from Songlines. Now I'm blanking.
I don't know. I don't think so. I think you're right. Because I've read Songlines and I haven't, okay. and I don't remember that. Although I was like, you know, I read Songlines like 20 years ago or something like that, but like, I love that concept. And now I need to go like, look it up because the idea of something that does prey on us, that's not just like every once in a while, oh, someone died from an exploratory bite, which is a term that I love, or whatever, that like actually something has grown to eat us, to prey upon us, has evolved in that way. You know, leopards are kind of close to that in their way because they eat a lot of like apes or they eat a lot of monkeys. And so like they're able to grab and penetrate skulls and that kind of stuff, but it's not really, you know, like it's not really there. Yeah.
I mean, and this is making me think to what you quoted sort of earlier, referencing the scenes I write about where I'm trying to figure out if I'm right to feel afraid, or rather I feel sort of ashamed that I'm afraid. And I think part of what this is like, there's a real desire to know that your fear or your feeling of being chased is warranted and is like rational. Like there's so much sort of gaslighting around, gosh, too trendy of a word. I'm like, what's the other word for this? But like we have a hard time trusting our own feelings. And like, if there was a creature that I knew was hunting me, wouldn't it make more sense if I was afraid walking in the woods rather than like, there is this one in 10,000 chance that I'm going to have an interaction with a predator. And like, I'm nervous about that. Like, I think the statistical improbability makes the fear more uncomfortable. and that was, you know, these experiences that I was having as like a young person moving through the world and feeling like, okay, I feel nervous about this interaction I've had with a stranger, but I'm actually not sure that if somebody else hadn't intervened, it would have gone badly. And so not only am I feeling afraid about what happened, but I'm feeling deeply uncomfortable with my own not knowing of whether I'm actually at threat. And it's basically like a failure to trust my own instincts that is perhaps almost more unsettling than whatever is happening outside with this interaction with another person.
Yeah. Well, I mean, who would you talk to if you got attacked by wolves? You know, there'd be nobody to talk to about it. I'm remembering this, like this woman who I forget her name. gosh, I wish I remembered her name right now, but she was abducted by a serial killer, and she was like stuffed in his trunk. And I mean, it's just the story is just awful. He like tied her up and she escaped. And when she told her family, her mom was like, oh, you're just making up those stories again, you know? And it actually, like 15 years or some long, inordinate amount of time passed before the police like called her and they're like, hey, remember that report you filed like forever ago? And she's like, wait, that was real? Like, she actually couldn't even believe herself that it was real anymore, because it was such a singular experience that there was just nobody to talk to about it. And sometimes like these events, you know, when they're not shareable, when there's nobody to talk to. So this is, you know, I guess a community thing, but like when there's nobody to like be with in it, it's like gaslighting isn't the word for this either. It's like, there's actually, there's no room for that experience. And then, you know, and then there's like the other side of that, which is like the kind of violent events that happen to so many people that like we pretend don't happen. Whether it's like violence, you know, that's enacted through people being harmed at work and exploited by their jobs. It could be sexual violence, domestic abuse, like whatever. And we just go on pretending those things don't happen. And so like, there's all these different ways of not being able to share. But if you really have an experience, if you went out to the woods and wolves attacked you, who the fuck is going to, first of all, like, who are you going to talk to at all about it? And I guess you could show the wounds, but like, you know, I'm sure a lot of people would be like, oh, it was probably a dog, or like, did you just fall down? You know, I mean, it's just, it would be so hard for culture to even allow that narrative in. Although I think at least people are so, again, like charged up by hearing about animals attacking people that they might take an interest, you know?
Well, and I mean, this is, you're conjuring the boy who cried wolf, and the ways that like the figure of the wolf has become sort of like a metonym for inventing this like tall tale about fear or fear of nature. And so those scripts are at play too, right? And I don't know, I'm thinking about what you're saying about like, how do we narrate these things? And the experience of like writing about anything on the page is you're sort of like selecting and choosing and trying to figure out how to take the reader into where you are. And I had experiences earlier where I was writing these scenes and thinking about many of the experiences that I'm writing about are with fear are very sort of mundane and small. And that's kind of the point, like similar to the wolf that I'm following. I'm just like one person collared, sort of tracking my own movements. And that's all I have access to is like the GPS coordinates of my own life. And so that's what I'm going to reveal. And I can picture like an early reader sort of saying like, well, this is a pretty standard assault. So I don't know that it belongs in here, right? And I think I've talked about this before, but like that is something catalyzed in me, which is like, what is a standard assault? What is a standard workplace violation that by being so standard, for example, would be beyond, it's too small for narrative. So like certain things are too small for narrative and certain things are like too big for narrative. Like, how do you give voice to this thing? And I think so much of like what writing, the sort of like impulse I have is like, how do you make the familiar strange? As my old sociology professor said, like, how do I make this thing that is like a mundane moment on a dance floor, perhaps? Why is it mundane? Why has the world said like this thing that happens that feels like a violation is actually like quite everyday? So it's therefore not worthy of narrative. And I think, I don't know, those questions of like what we normalize and how do we narrate the things that feel so normal that they don't deserve narration. I think I was like interested in that impulse.
Yeah, I mean, that's so interesting, because like also the normalization could actually render real discussion too. So you don't want to throw the normalization out. It's like,
exactly.
That's part of what restorative justice and abolitionist like movements like take up, which is we've all harmed each other. We've all probably crossed someone's boundaries and had our boundaries crossed. And like sometimes it was totally innocent and sometimes it was purposeful. And like sometimes we've, you know, people have committed crimes and not gotten caught and just lived with it. And some people have gotten caught and, you know, are punished in extreme bizarre ways and like so on and so forth. But that's part of being human. So that actually needs to be normalized before we start talking about it. Before we start sort of strangifying it or making it extraordinary by state intervention or legal intervention or some sort of apparatus that pretends to understand what's going on here so it can just do something about it immediately. Actually, we need to have conversations about it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think this also goes to, it goes back to that question of like scripts and the sort of porousness between our own lives and the sort of like world we're inheriting. And how do you make those feedback loops is like, yeah, but how do you make visible that the ways that we're all part of these worlds and systems and what is normal? You know, it was very normal to smoke in an airplane at a certain moment. And so, yeah, I don't know. I've been thinking today, you know, going into this conversation about this situation that happened in Wyoming with the wolf. I'm not sure how much international headlines it's made, but basically a hunter in Wyoming ran over a wolf with a snowmobile recently. And then he took the wolf injured, duct taped its mouth, and brought it into a local bar where he sort of showed it off. People took pictures, they were hugging with it, they're drinking, and then he killed the wolf. And what happened from the state of Wyoming was that he was fined $250 essentially for not killing the wolf immediately because it was wounded. So that was sort of the harm. And basically the reason is that in Wyoming and similarly in Idaho and Montana, like predators are not subject to the same animal cruelty laws. They're sort of anything can happen. And so there's been like major outcry. It's horrifying. It's this really archaic seeming thing where you have a wolf that is sort of tortured, paraded around, and then killed. And yet it's not breaking any laws. There's sort of no culpability. There's groups trying to get a felony charge on this guy. Anyway, I could go on and on about this because it's been such a sickening example of the ways that like harm against wolves begins to feel like so much bigger than the wolf itself. It's about a man versus nature thing. It's about a man versus dominance. And I say this, I guess, to go back to this idea of time and what is normal. And like, I think the feeling I had in talking to some friends and colleagues in Wyoming is like, this feels like the past has come back. Like, this is like these old narratives of sort of settlers torturing wolves that are this part of the fabric of American dominance of nature history narratives. But it feels like we've moved past them in some way, or it's easy to feel that. And yet, look at, here's this wolf that's being wounded and paraded around a bar. And so,
yeah, I mean, totally. And then of course it just brings in every question about like, well, what about factory farms? What about, what about like all the ways in which we interact with animals? There's that book by Hal Herzog, which is Some We Love, Some We Hate, Some We Eat. And like, he kind of really can't get to an answer. He's like, well, where, like, he comes close to answers again and again, like why we treat certain animals certain ways. But, you know, reflexively, that's what I think when I hear this story. I'm like, well, but what about these, you know? And it's not to evade the question of the wolf, but rather just to broaden, you know, or the cruelty to the wolf, but to broaden the scope of, you know, considering what constitutes cruelty and who's leveling the accusation of cruelty and what they do in their own lives, because that hearing that should in some way make us feel implicated. In the same way you're talking about wolves and ecology and how that relates to, I think it was your mom having, you know, a tick-based disease and how there's like less, you know, ticks when wolves are around and all that kind of stuff. Like tracing these connections between ourselves and the animals we encounter, when we hear that story about the wolf, that should happen. But usually what happens is that there's a dead ending into, well, don't be mean to that wolf. It was like when was it Jared Kushner or someone was like, went big game hunting and everybody lost their minds. And I was like, yeah, but like what, like we don't have factory farms in Ireland. Thank God. There's one in Northern Ireland that's, I think, owned by the Chinese government, like a pig farm, in cooperation with the UK, but we don't do that here. And
just incredible for us to remember, like there is another world possible.
Yeah, right? Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and we're a small island, but like massive agricultural, like agriculture is like the industry of this place, and we don't have factory farms. And so like, then when I look at the US, and that is obviously just abject fucking cruelty, and on so many levels, not just for the animals, but for the people, for the surrounding, for the people that live there, for the workers, all that kind of stuff. And so I wanted to create those connections, but it's also hard to create those connections without dismissing the singular cruelty to that one wolf. Mm-hmm. So I also have to do that balancing act when I hear the story.
Yeah. I mean, I'm so glad you bring that up. I think like so much of what we expect is, well, human cruelty towards an animal that is, quote, lesser than us, or that is like a prey animal feels different than human cruelty to a quote, predator animal. And like, why is that, right? We expect cows to be, quote, dominated by humans. And there was this amazing paper that I read that was like a roundtable of animal studies researchers talking about just basically like gender and the subjugation of farm animals, and like how that goes against sort of like parallels subjugation of women and other groups of people, right? And it's, you can't talk about factory farming and this sort of like sterilization and forced breeding without talking about, of course, there's these seepages between how we think about human reproduction, or we think about control. And which is to say, like, yeah, this goes back to these earlier questions about domestic versus wild, quote unquote, and how do we treat those two senses of animals differently? Wolf dogs, I get asked about a lot. Like, people are often telling me, like, I have this wolf dog and it's a really great animal. And that's, yes, like, singularly, you could have this wonderful experience with this animal. Like, I'm not taking that away. And also, this is a creature that, like, does not want to probably live in your house. And, like, Where do I go?
I mean, it's just, I mean, these are the things that come up. I think it's difficult too, because then when you try to sort of think into the cow or sort of think into some of these animals, even though this is a controversial thing and maybe we can go there or not, I don't think that they think in the way that we do. Certainly there's a, a great, there's a scientist, Herman Poppelbaum, and he said this, you know, the essential difference between man and man, he would say, because it came out, whatever, between man and animal is not that man has more wisdom than the animal, but that the wisdom among the animals comes to light at another level of the whole being. Wisdom dwells deeper within the organism itself. And I do accept that as true. And that has implications for how I view animals and interact with the quote unquote natural world. But so like, if I try to sort of think into the cow or think into some of these prey animals, it's just like we're throwing back to the discussion we're having before about, well, what if there was something that were preying on us? Well, what does it mean to actually have that be a part of life and have that be sort of ingrained in the being? I don't want to say you expect to be eaten exactly, but life is a relationship to the possibility of being eaten in a different way. Mm-hmm. Just like ants dealing with the scale of the world around them, which also the scale of the insects, if we want to talk about where the real scale of the animal world is, it's amongst that level, not ours, because there are so many more of them. Mm-hmm. But the scale of like things being able to crush you at any moment, of like water being able, drops of water coming in as floods, of all these variations. And then also your sense of time would be different. Like, I can begin to kind of understand that. Now, I hate like object-oriented ontology, and I hate like, like, what does the dresser drawer think? Like, I don't want to like do that. But if I'm just trying to relate to form some sort of ethical relationship to how I eat or how I view animals, that is something that I think would be different probably for certain animals than others. The idea of, well, experience relates to being consumed in a different way.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it makes me think of very early on, I had this question about like, what is the experience of an antelope, say, or an elk? How aware are they of being eaten at any point of their life? Like, what's the pie chart of their brain about predation? How much is that kind of animating their day-to-day experience of being an antelope? And I think I was thinking about this when I felt like a lot of my life was through that lens of like being in public was potentially being afraid of an altercation because I'd had some, and that was an uncomfortable way to go through the world. And like, we can't, how do I know that about the antelope, right? Like I actually can't fully, you can't get inside that experience. I mean, part of what you're saying, I'm thinking about like just the ways that we think about intelligence and knowledge, and like wolves can communicate through gaze signal. They can communicate through the howls. You know, they can tell from urine on the ground if the, like what the age and sex and meal of the last wolf that passed by was. So, you know, in so many ways, I'm thinking like there are these forms of intelligence that like we can't understand as humans, and like, how do we, yes, you know, they are not the same as us, but there's a degree that like our own paucity of imagination makes our world smaller, and trying to understand the experience. I think, I mean, on some level, this book was like, what does it feel like to be a wolf in the world? What does it feel like to be somebody hunted by a wolf or some creature hunted by a wolf in the world? And like, I can never get inside either of those two positions. So instead I'm just going to like, but I think there's a real value to like putting on the costumes of imagining those things. And I just am so interested in all of us like doing that sort of dress up outside of our own experience, because our experiences of the world are so subjective, and we often like fail to realize the ways that we're subjective and think, well, this is just my gut impulse. This is like my wiring. This is just the way that I love. This is the way that I fear. And yet, no.
Yeah. I love that you bring up that, the story of St. Francis and the wolf in your book, because it's like St. Francis approaches the wolf and sort of does what no one else did, which is now St. Francis is singular being, so it's a bit different that maybe others couldn't do this, but St. Francis approaches and says, you know, what is it that you need? Like, I'm going to try to understand you. And that in fact is the St. Francis prayer, not to be understood, to understand, not to be understood, or not to be understood, but to understand. And I think it's like, it's something like that, what I'm trying to, like think about these experiences that animals have, if experience is even the right word. Mm-hmm. You know, there's that Wittgenstein quote, if a lion could speak, we couldn't understand it, which I love. It just gives me so much insight where, but we still, like, I love that there's the little sneaky part in there, which is that Wittgenstein saying, but we still know the lion speaking. We just wouldn't know, we just couldn't understand it, right? Mm-hmm. I think that there's a way in which, yeah, we can't enter into the experience, but we can touch it. Like we can touch it from the outside somehow, or that we can approach it or be get into proximity, like a closer proximity with it. I'm thinking also about like, I'm sure you've had this experience. Like if I'm walking down the street with someone, like I find like really doughy, chubby dudes hot, right? So if like they're kind of fat, they got big ears, they've got big chubby cheeks, like I just think that's really hot. And I could be walking down the street with someone, a friend, and I'd be like, oh, check out that guy. And my friend would be like, him? Are you serious? You know, there's this like quick desire shaming that usually happens. And what I tell people to do in that moment, if they're with their friends or their partners, is instead just to say, oh, what do you find attractive about them? Mm-hmm. Like to try to open up the experience rather than shut it down. However, I'm acutely aware that whoever's with me, even if they ask me that question, is probably never going to feel the desire that I feel for that person. Mm-hmm. So we can inquire and we can create bridges, but we can't inhabit exactly. And I think but the inquiring and the bridges still open something up, whereas there's a shutting down otherwise.
That's so interesting. And what I started thinking about was like, what do we feel, and I'm using the royal we, like privy to any kind of knowledge. I think this is like what the internet has broken about my brain, is I think I should be able to find anything. And I think that I should be able to track down anyone and write a message on some thing. Like, who can I not interview? Who can I not ask the questions to? Like, we're in this kind of modern world. I mean, and even like bring in Esther Perel, bring in the ways that we talk about, if you communicate in a good way, you can get to any solution. That's a sort of fallacy of, and I like love Esther, but I think there is this like overemphasis on just like the value of communication to understand, or the value of like, we're in this great information age where there's like repositories of every kind of knowledge and archival history. And yet like, there's so much I'm not privy to, and coming up against the limits of what we can understand, and like, the humbleness of being able to be like, I will never understand your desire. Like, as you were talking, I was thinking of Amiya Srinivasan's book about like, what do we inherit about how we think about desire? And yeah, I mean, we do that self-inventory, but there's also such a value to being like, this door is shut to me and I cannot understand it. And like, that is actually part of the experience of like, understanding my own experience being in my body is like, getting the limits of it and also understanding the limitlessness of it.
Yeah. And then also seeing that the limits are the exact thing which brings a togetherness. So it's like, obviously, you know, when I, I have like this sort of boundaried body in my incarnation, and like, if I touch someone else, I encounter the limits of my own being. But the way I also connect with someone is by touching them. So the inner experience of warmth comes from experiencing the separateness, or the outpicturing of separateness brings the inner experience of warmth and connection. And so there's this like inversion property that allows us to be close. And so it is that thing where it's like, you know, you talked about just staring into your dog's eyes and trying to figure out, what's going on with you? What was your dog's name?
Cricket.
What is it? Cricket?
Cricket.
Yeah, what's going on with you, Cricket? Like, what's going on? You know, like looking at Cricket's eyes and just being like, I can't know. And yet my inability to know does bring a kind of connection. And I think that that's really special. It's like, it doesn't just shut things down. It actually creates an inner sort of striving to be with the other.
Totally. And I think I'm just looking for, I have this quote written down right now on my, okay. So from environmental gender scholar, Kari Whale, who talks about like it, trying to envision what a parrot is thinking is also to imagine what a human means when she opens her mouth. Right. And she says, are we not all dependent upon a field of signification that precedes us, making it difficult to say that any language is ever not imitative? How do we know what our lovers mean when they say, I love you? And this is that question that like looking at a parrot and trying to figure out what the parrot is saying, looking at the dog, it destabilizes our sense of like looking at the human, right? Looking like we coexist with our pets and also our partners or our roommates in ways where we like take our bodies for granted and take our communication for granted. And when you like make that slippery or strange and you sort of realize like, what is this creature actually thinking? There's something so liberating about the total lack of control that you have when you acknowledge, like, I cannot understand this. deeply alienating and alone making sometimes. Like, I think I have my biggest moments of like, it's 3 a.m. and I'm lying awake and I feel like I'm alone in the world. That feeling that I remember from childhood can happen also when I'm like with another being and I cannot understand. We cannot communicate, right?
Yeah. Well, and I mean, if to extend that, you know, to one limit at least is just to say, like, how do I know that the other exists? And I mean, rather than just sort of rejecting solipsism and saying, well, you just know, like, other people are apparently real, I would say, no, like, actually, none of you are real. Like, it's but you are all part of me. And this sounds so egotistical, but I don't mean it in that way. It's like, or maybe I completely mean it that way. But the act of granting you your own existence is actually an act of love. It's not an act of like command or dominion. It's saying like, I love you enough to admit that you may exist outside of me, that there's a real unknowing. And this is actually loving to be like, well, you are part of me, but you know what? Like, I see that you're here and I'm not going to deny that there's a separation or a space between us. Gosh, this is like we're getting here from starting about this talking about wolves. that's like exactly the gift of your book. And I think it's something I wish more people would do, is just like, you know, like see where it goes. Yeah.
I mean, I was thinking about wolves as you were talking, and now I've forgotten what I was going to say about them, because there is the creature outside of yourself that you cannot understand. I think about this with a collared wolf, where there's this fantasy of, I understand the collared wolf. I get the GPS coordinates. I can plot on a map. And yet you only like the collar comes live. I forget how often the frequency is that it sends the coordinates. But the whole point is like, there are these nodes of knowledge, and then there are these like valleys in between where we don't know. And we can extrapolate what the wolf is doing. But like, even that, the idea that a collared wolf is controlled, is this landscaped wolf, as you sort of said earlier beautifully, like even that acknowledges like, it's also a deeply unknown wolf in these moments in between, right? Like we just cannot, and so how do we let the wolf be a creature that is wild, that does not exist for us? You know, there's many studies that are coming out about trying to quantify the sort of like economic value of having wolves in the landscape. And some of these are like, wolves will scare deer off the highways, so people have fewer deer car collisions in Wisconsin. And this is fascinating to me, right? Like the idea that wolves are like helping car insurance companies by keeping deer off the highway. And similarly, that wolves will prey on animals that are sick. Chronic wasting disease is a big problem in some like deer populations, and wolves kind of will cull the herds of those. And so then hunters is potentially like, you know, keeping people safe. And yet, what does it mean to want to protect the wolf? Not because economically or sort of like, you know, epidemiologically it's helping us, but just because like the wolf deserves to live a life that I will never be privy to, even if the wolf is collared, and therefore I should like advocate for its safety, or its it deserves that opportunity to live. And then I think, you know, via your earlier point, like, isn't that true for many other animals whose lives we are actually like circumscribing within our own desires for? This cow deserves to live for X and Y purpose for myself. And like, how do we think about other creatures untethered from our own desires for them?
Yeah. Well, and like, is that possible? But what I don't mean when I say, is that possible, is this sort of like cost benefit analysis, selfish gene, like old version of evolution nonsense, that we can never act altruistically and that we can only act out of our own interest. But rather, like, the moment we enter into the question, we establish that a relationship exists. So then can we ask ourselves something like, how can we relate to each other? And by relating, I don't just mean your function in the world, but and what you offer traffic or deer or, you know, or my fantasies of rewilding, but actually like what in me is you, you know? I might not ever know what in you is me, but what in me is you? And like, how can I connect to that and like respond to that properly? And I think that like, it just raises so many questions. Now, listen, I want to kind of, as we sort of wind down, I want to make sure I ask you a much more podcasty type question here, which is like just a direct question. You've probably been asked this before, but like, I'm sure you're still interested in wolves. So like, I would never ask you like, have you become sick of them? But I'm just wondering, the book came out pretty recently, but you wrote it, and anybody who writes a book knows that it takes like a long time for the book to actually come out. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly you're thrown into the conversations about the thing that's in the book that you wrote like a long time ago and blah, blah, blah. But I'm just wondering where your thoughts are now in relationship to the topics, maybe not the wolf itself, but the things that came up in the book and what directions your thinking is going in with them.
Yeah. I mean, I'm curious for your example, your sort of experience with that is like, as time becomes this buffer between you and the subject, it becomes so separate. It's like this like amputated limb and it's like sitting over there and you feel so connected to it, but also like repulsed by it. Like that's sort of, there's some sense of,
I would say that I wrote this book because I was trying to figure out on a very deep level, like what to do with my own fears around moving through the world. And in a way, writing the book became a salve. I didn't mean that it would, but like that was no longer the dominant question in my life. And so I like grew out of the shell of the book that I was writing myself into in a way. And I think the question that I've been left with is like, I still think I'm writing about climate change now and just like still continued like environmental uncertainty. But given that we cannot control for that fear or diminish it, like what do we have to buoy ourselves? In my mind, that's like relationships with each other and love and thinking about the ways that it started. This is where my brain has gone now, is like thinking about romance and the possibilities of this as like a form of creating excitement in the future, like the kind of like crush energy of there's something that I want to see kindled in the future actually makes the future possible. It actually like makes it creates sort of like fuel for the future. And I was thinking about all the ways that I struggle to envision the future and struggle to get excited about it, given reports on climate change and just like the general feelings I wake up with sometimes. And yet, like what makes me want to vault into that future, it's thinking about love. And so I'm writing about ideas of love right now in human and non-human ways, that like how the ways we relate to one another are sort of shifting as our environment changes. And I think centrally, I'm really interested in the question of like how the environment shapes our sort of, again, emotional scripts. Like I think of myself as reacting totally based on my own impulses. And yet I am I'm in love in different ways when I'm living through wildfires trapped in my basement with my partner. and so I'm just interested in those questions of like, yeah, how do we buffer the fear and uncertainty? I suppose I'm still.
Yeah. I mean, it's just it's like a different stage for a related idea. I hate when people say, oh, we only have like one book in us or whatever, but like you can see how those two ideas connect for sure. Like, how do I experience the enthusiasm that's close to danger or close to fear? But it's very different. It's also very different. And it sounds very exciting. I love that because it's something that I just is not talked about almost at all. You know, thinking about people that are in war zones, conflict zones or whatever, they're still talking about who they're attracted to. They're still talking about love and they're still having conversations with their loved ones, you know, and when people talk about that, it's often ridiculed, you know, like when Susan Sontag went to Sarajevo and directed Waiting for Godot while people were being shot, people made fun of that, but then people in Sarajevo named a square after her and they still talk about it, you know, you know, Foucault writing about political spirituality, people being connected to God in times that, you know, of revolution and resistance, like that was one of the most ridiculed things that he wrote. And yet it's quite obvious in Palestine that this idea of a connection to a spiritual life and talking about things in those terms is what's getting people, I don't know if through is the right word, unfortunately, but like giving people some strength, and some connection, you know, to the events. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that like perceived tension between like what is frivolous and what is serious, or I'm thinking about like, I was originally sort of like activated by a line in Sally Rooney's last novel where she was sort of talking about like, we could be saving the world and we're over here talking about our relationships. And I was just thinking about the ways that, yes, there is a tension between the essayist Leah Purpura talks about the custody of our gaze. I'm always thinking like, where is our gaze at any one moment? And sometimes if it's on like the subject that I am, say, having a crush on, it's not on this wider world. And yet I actually think it's more complicated than that. And I think there's a way that like the energy, like if I'm in love with someone, I'm also in love with the things that they're in love with. And like, I'm interested in ways that we can think about love being outward facing and not this kind of like bunker quality that often when people think about, oh, dating in the future, there's kind of this like humorous invocation of like, yeah, I want to be in my little, my commune with my people where we're all like churning butter together and protecting ourselves against like drought. And yet like, what does it mean to not be fantasizing a bunker future where you have like your hot Bon Iver husband who's like chopping wood. But instead you're like outwardly facing, and that love that potentially you're fantasizing between one partner or however many, like that's actually like an engine for engagement with the outer world, not a mode in which doors are closing to your outside engagement. Like I think the like solipsism of romance is somewhat false. It's just not true in my experience. Like there are ways that like being in love, I think, is really, it opens a lot of doors. It doesn't necessarily close them.
Yeah, I love that. That's something, I think Lacan said something like love is desiring the desire of the other, or something like that. And that I think about, just to kind of go back to you saying you're interested in how I land some of this, maybe I can say something that's productive to discussion. Like,
yeah,
I've been thinking a lot about writing this very short book on pornography because I was a sex worker for a long time. And like, that's what I used to write all these articles about sex work. And in fact, the very first public talk I ever gave was at Bowdoin College about pornography.
Oh, no way.
Yeah. They were the first people to
help. Incredible.
And the talk was called The Virtues of Being an Object. And it was packed. Like there were people standing in the hall. It was awesome. I should have asked for more money, but it was a great experience.
What year was that?
Gosh. It must have been like, let's say 2010, maybe.
Was so, Guy Mark Foster?
I don't remember. Yeah. But I could tell you later, though.
But
I was just thinking, like, I don't really talk about pornography that much anymore. I don't really... And people still want to interview me about it. Like they still want to interview me about sex work because I also did all like 10 years of like activism and like labor action for sex workers and all that. But I still have this little book in my head that I want to write. And I've been thinking about doing it because there's an opportunity with a small press to do it. And I'm like, but that's going to put me in that conversation. And I don't know if I can actually endure a deal with the conversation. I can deal with the book, but not the conversation. And so that's this whole other aspect of encountering ideas where it's like, how much of this idea can I endure? Like it's not easy. And I think that this is something that, you know, when people interview writers or talk with writers, they always, not always, but they often ask them process-based questions. They ask them, you know, sometimes they'll ask them questions about the content of the book. If it's a fiction writer, there's a lot of like, how do you write? When do you get up? All that kind of stuff. But it's very rarely asked, like, what did it mean to endure like the pressure or the presence of this idea and these pictures for like years or months or however long it took, and then to have them, you know, show up again after that gap. And it's really intense. And so that's why I kind of framed the question for you is not like, where are you with wolves now, but actually like, what's the sort of lingering presence of the ideas? Where are they going now? How have they evolved? And so then I can see very clearly how they've taken this new form and they kind of want you to do these new things with them or look with them in this different way. It's exciting. Mm-hmm.
Well, and I'm curious, like those ideas for you, that sounds fascinating. And I think a lot about like the borders of being a writer and like what amounts of yourself, especially in nonfiction, like you are giving, or you feel like you write a book, you give us 80 pages on the subject or 100 pages. Is there a way that like that can be the gift, but actually like part of being this like public intellectual is that then you have to like pad that with hours of conversation around it. But Yeah, I don't know. It's interesting to be like, what does it mean to give like a gift or a present that is very tightly wrapped, and like that is your contribution?
I mean, don't we all like want that? It's like, you know, that's like part of the fantasy. It's like, I'm just going to write the books and disappear. I'm just going to like total jam Katsuya, maybe give a prize as talk when I win the Nobel Prize or something like that. But I was going to write these books, disappear. You can pick them up. You can do whatever you want with it, but I'm not engaging otherwise. My God, it seems like the absolute fantasy, which is why I'm always like, why are J.K. Rowling and Stephen King ever like opening their mouths on, like, isn't the whole point of being a famous, successful writer that you don't have to speak in public ever again? You know?
And like, totally. And yet, like, you know, I'm thinking about the ways that like the object, as soon as you write it, is imperfect. And like, I appreciate the chance to be like talking around it and padding it in a way because yes, you're like revising it. But yeah, 100% there is.
I mean, that was when my novel came out, like I was really excited to have those conversations. One, because I just always wanted to do a book tour my whole life. And like, I got to do it and it was fucking great. And then I got to have, you know, I got to have those interactions with readers of my work. I love that. But do I want that? That was a novel. And I think I will always want that with a novel. But it's why now all my nonfiction just goes on the podcast. I don't know. Like, so I'm curating the conversations that I have around the nonfiction ideas. I don't know if I want to have those conversations outwardly. Now, listen, everybody, if those books come out, please have me come read at your bookstore and give events and give talks. But anyway, yeah.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, I think the experience of publishing anything as a nonfiction author, you're trying to control so closely. You're creating a character of yourself on the page and trying to control how that character is mediated with. And yet, like, you're not in control of it as soon as it exits. And I say it because, like, that is what the Erica on the page feels like. Like, she feels like this, like, it. It's no longer me. Yeah. And it's been very funny to have like friends who knew me as a young person, like, you describe these experiences of intense anxiety, but like, you were always so joyful, and like, we don't understand. There's this like cognitive gap between who I am on the page and who they remember me as potentially. And I'm like, well, that gap is the whole point. Like, the point is that I was presenting as someone else, and yet like, this is also a version of self. And I think part of what writing does for me and writing nonfiction does for me is like, accepts my sort of like kaleidoscopic and yet constant identity, and the ways that like, how am I going to understand, how is someone going to understand or know me? You know, somebody was just at a reading of mine and he said, I've read, finished the book, and I felt like I knew you better than I knew myself. I'm like, well, there's a lot to unpack there. Like, what version of me did you know? And what version of yourself do you know? And like, I always think that like, why I love reading first person is that like, it is forcing me to feel the other person's experiences like echoing inside my own. And there's just this like breakdown of self, but also, I don't know. Yeah, it's weird that I become a vessel then for like this, you know, older man's like self-knowledge. But
well, no, I mean, it's cool, but then it's like, I mean, I had so many people, I mean, the common thing, and this happens with novelists all the time, so this isn't special. Like, people are like, how much of this was based on your experience? But like, the book is like really like over the top crazy. Like, if some of it was like my experience, like, this is a real problem there. But like, some of it, of course, could have been. But I was always like, none of it. Like, I mean, some of it, I guess, like, there are things in here that I remember, little scraps here and there, but not really a lot of it. But then, you know, some people from my family were like, oh, this is so clearly about this thing that happened in our life. And I was like, no, it really isn't. And then a lot of people that knew me were, you know, they were like, I'm so sorry. Like, I didn't know this was going on for you. So there was all of that. But then my cousin came to my reading at the Strand, and he pointed out that the main character of my book, Todd, and one of the other characters, Elaine, Todd is my cousin, is my cousin, his brother, and Elaine is his mom. And I was like, I didn't even think about those names as I was writing it. So there is shit in there. So I, like, at once I'm just like, yeah, no, like, this isn't my life, blah, blah, blah. And then someone, you know, does a little psychoanalysis, like, check out your Freudian slip names here. And I'm like, oh, fuck. like, actually, there must be all kinds of stuff in there that relates to things that I didn't know at all.
Mm-hmm. That's hilarious. It's so true. And I think, you know, that idea that people are more upset by not being in your work in a quiet way than being in it. Yeah. The best advice I got on this was, like, if you're writing about people in negative ways, just give them really good hair.
That's great. Well, listen, it's nice to meet this version of you, Erica Berry. And thank you so much for writing the book, writing all the essays that you write, and for having this conversation with me.
Thank you so much for having me here and a part of all these conversations you're doing on this podcast. I love it a lot.
Thank you. And everybody, thanks so much for listening. Bye now.